Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. Greed can come in any form, but it takes a special kind of greed to kill someone for money. When someone feels entitled to something, and then it's taken away from them, it can fuel a rage so blinding that they are willing to get rid of anyone who stands in their way. This is about a murder in Mississippi. Okay, on to the show. February 14th, 2004, Yazoo City, Mississippi. The day was here. After 3 years of not seeing his cousin Michael, Ernest Lee Hargan knew what he had to do. He was tired of being overshadowed by him. His father Charles passed away a month before, but not before he could do something that would change the life of Ernest and Michael forever. Ernest had been adopted into the Hargan family when he was younger, and Charles was his father, in every sense of the word. It's safe to say that although Charles loved Ernest, he was tired of his behavior. His son was over 40, had a son, and was married. It was about time you start to get right. He finally had enough when he found out that Ernest was taking drugs and had become addicted to meth. Although they were estranged, in some way Charles hoped that his son would turn it around. He gave him until December of 2003 to make amends, or there would be consequences. Not one for ultimatums, Ernest never saw his father again. On January 3rd, 2004, just 13 days before his death, Charles decided to amend the will and made his great-nephew, Michael Hargan, and another family member, Doris Lott, the heir to his 50-acre Madison County farm. Ernest couldn't believe the disloyalty. This is exactly why he stayed away from his family. He and his wife Lisa had a nice plot of land where she had her veterinary practice. But that wasn't enough for him. He had to have what he felt was his. Ernest Hargan wasn't the first person to bring tragedy to the Hargan doorstep. The house that Michael lived in was previously Fowler Road Grocery, a one-story brick building that was a convenience store run by the Hargan family until 1994. It was in 1994 that the convenience store was closed and turned into Michael's family home. Dan Haywood Hargan, the patriarch of the Hargan family and Michael's father, was murdered when three men, Forrest Branch, Ronnie Joe Wright, and James Wesley Jackson, entered the store, shot him, and then proceeded to rob him. The robbery was interrupted when a customer walked in. The three men ran out with $114 to their name and blood on their hands. They were eventually caught and convicted of capital murder. It is the murder of Haywood that led Diane Hargan, Michael's mother, to say, "Maybe pride was our sin that caused this to happen. We were so proud to be Hargans. This family did anything and everything for friends, family, or even strangers in need." It would be this helpful nature that would bring adopted cousin Ernest Lee Hargan into the life of Michael Hargan. Michael was described as an easygoing country boy. He was a construction worker by trade who was witty and generous. He'd give you the shirt off his back. He was married to his wife Rebecca, who was a physical therapist. She too was generous and kind, and most people had nothing but great things to say about her. Together, they had 4-year-old son, James Patrick. He was a ray of sunshine in his parents' life, happy, bubbly, well-rounded. He was given the name of his great-grandfather and expected to carry on the Hargan name for a very long time. However, that dream would be cut short. Ernest Lee did not hesitate to discuss his displeasure with being cut out of the will with friends and family. He was ready to do something about it. During the early morning hours of February 14, 2004, Ernest would get into his 1974 Corvette and drive to Michael Hargan's home. Michael, who had just returned from breakfast with a close friend, arrived home to a still-sleeping household. Ernest soon arrived and began to bang on the door. Alarmed and most likely frustrated, Michael pulled on his boots and answered the door. He was immediately met with a brawl. Michael and Ernest viciously fought, and eventually the fight made its way outside. Michael was attempting to run to his truck where he kept his gun, but Ernest grabbed his gun first and shot Michael in the head with a .22 caliber pistol. He made his way inside, where a confused and groggy Rebecca sat up in her bed. He began to beat Rebecca, and she fought back, hard. She was no match for Ernest, who eventually shot her in the arm and subdued her by choking her into unconsciousness. 4-year-old James Patrick began to cry, and Ernest choked him too. Rebecca and James were not dead when Ernest Lee threw them in his car, on top of the dying Michael Hargan. He noticed that he was low on gas, and if he had planned to make it all the way back to his intended destination, he needed to fill up. So he pulled into a service station where Rebecca and James were still sitting in the front seat. To onlookers, they looked as if they had just fallen asleep. No one had any way of knowing that they were sitting on top of Michael's now deceased body. He filled up and continued to Taylorsville, 100 miles from Michael's home. He discarded the pistol along the way and pulled into a wooded area used for hunting. It was only a few miles from his farm. He took Rebecca out of the car, leaving a semi-conscious James Patrick in the car. He beat and manually strangled her until he knew she was dead. For James Patrick, he was more brutal. The 4-year-old had regained consciousness and was mute with fear. Ernest took him out of the car, wrapped a leather strap around his neck, pulled on it hard, and placed him in his mother's now cold embrace. He left him to die, which he did within minutes. Ernest would later say, "The baby didn't even cry." He dragged Michael out of the car and placed him in close proximity to Rebecca and James. He covered their bodies with some brush. He got back in his car and drove home, returned to the scene later with his truck, and took them further down the road and buried them in a shallow grave, throwing pieces of tin from his truck bed to conceal the bodies. A neighbor had passed by earlier in the day and noticed that the door to Michael Hargan's home was open. They found this odd and got out to check on the family. They arrived upon a scene of spent casings and blood. They called the police, and the family was reported missing and possibly endangered. That evening, Ernest and his wife Lisa went to dinner. She could tell something was off with her husband. She figured it was as a result of the will, and she was right. She wouldn't have to guess much longer, because Ernest told her, "I got them. All three." She was confused by his statement, and took it as Ernest letting off steam. She knew he had been angry about the will and other things like, was Benny Fisher, a longtime employee and friend of Ernest Lee, going to be treated right under the new patriarch, Michael? He was concerned that Benny would be mistreated, just as he had been by Charles. She ignored her instinct and finished dinner. The next day, she would be in a whirlwind of confusion. The news broke that Michael and his family were missing. Few details were released, but they were believed to be in danger. Lisa didn't know what to do. She didn't want to bring a light of suspicion on her husband, if he was innocent. But there was doubt in her mind about his innocence in all of this. Could he really be capable of hurting his family? Law enforcement heard from various family members and friends that Ernest had been talking about the will just 3 days before the disappearance. He was suspect number one. Authorities returned to the home of Michael Hargan to continue collecting evidence, which included spent casings from a .22 caliber pistol, blood evidence, and teeth that were found near Michael Hargan's truck. They knew it was likely that the Hargans had been murdered and disposed of, but they weren't ready to release that information out to the public. As the investigation continued, the FBI joined in and combed through over 500 leads regarding the case. Various law enforcement from neighboring towns joined in the search to find the family. Investigators continue to hear about Ernest and his feelings towards his father and now towards his cousin, Michael. It was time to bring him in for questioning. On February 27, 2004, he is brought in for questioning regarding the disappearance of Michael, Rebecca, and James Patrick Hargan. After the first day of questioning, officials requested a warrant to search the property of Ernest Lee Hargan. It was granted, and they began the search. Lisa was removed from the home, and her practice was closed until the search was complete. During their search, they found meth and an AR-15 assault rifle, which could have easily been converted into an automatic weapon, or was in the process of being converted into an automatic weapon. Charges were filed against him on February 29th for being in possession of methamphetamines and the assault weapon. This was also the day that Lisa shared with investigators what Ernest had told her during their Valentine's Day dinner, that he had got them, all three. Investigators brought this information to Ernest, who confessed to murdering his cousin and his family. They were shocked that the confession came quickly, and they pounced on his openness and asked where the Hargans were. He drew a crude map of where they were buried, and investigators brought him along to search for the bodies. On March 1st, the shallow grave containing the bodies of 27-year-old Michael Hargan, 29-year-old Rebecca Hargan, and 4-year-old James Patrick Hargan was found. He was booked on 3 counts of capital murder. They began collecting evidence from the scene where Rebecca and James Patrick were murdered and from the burial site. Ernest was transported back to jail to await his arraignment hearing. The Hargan family reeled from the news that Ernest had been arrested for the murders. His stepfather, Jack Glancy, spoke to the Daily Dunklin Democrat after learning of the news, stating, "I feel terribly sorry for him, but I don't know if he wants to see me. He may be so ashamed. I don't know why he would even have anything against Michael. He stayed away from them. He was a shunner, I guess you would say." 3 days later, a funeral for all three victims was held at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Canton, Mississippi. Over 300 people would be in attendance. Autopsy reports would later conclude that Michael Hargan fought viciously for his life. He suffered a broken jaw and had some of his teeth knocked out. The injury that caused his death was a shot to the left side of his head. Rebecca Hargan had defensive injuries on her hand and arms, possibly from trying to block punches to her head. James Patrick did not have any defensive injuries, but he was no match for a 40-plus-year-old male. On August 2nd, Ernest would enter a plea of not guilty to the 3 counts of capital murder. District Attorney James Powell was confident in his case against Ernest Lee Hargan, and he had every right to be. It was rock solid. The jury would hear of the vicious nature in which the Hargan family was murdered. When it came to the murder of James Patrick and Ernest's statements about how the boy didn't cry, the jury was visibly shaken. Ernest even began to cry. And I'm not sure if this is because he was sober for the most part and hearing about how this little boy died, but I find it strange that he was so cool and calculated whenever he was murdering this family and so callous in wrapping a strap around a 4-year-old's throat that then he would sit there and cry. And I'm not sure if it's a manipulation thing where he was trying to get sympathy from the jurors, but if he could tell that they were visibly shaken, perhaps he was putting on a show of sorts to show that, yes, you know, I'm a monster and I get it. His defense team didn't really put on a case. They called no witnesses, and Ernest never testified in his own trial. A twist in the trial came a week before it was due to end. Judge Janie Lewis reduced the capital murder charge for Michael Hargan to murder. In the ruling, she concluded that prosecutors had not proven that another felony had occurred as required by law to support the capital murder charge. But on December 4th, 2005, after 2 hours of deliberations, the jury brought back a guilty verdict for 2 counts of capital murder for Rebecca and James and 1 count of murder for Michael. The family of Michael Hargan was pleased. Only one person was missing from the courtroom, his mother, Diane. She died of cancer on November 10th, 2005. Michael's sister, Jennifer McBride, was pleased with the verdict and wished her mother could have been present with her. Just a day after the verdict was issued, on December 5, 2005, the sentencing phase began, and after 4 hours of deliberation, the jury sentenced Ernest Lee Hargan to death by lethal injection. The family of Rebecca was not pleased with the outcome, as they did not believe in the death penalty, but they were relieved that Ernest would never be released from prison. Jennifer McBride, Michael's sister, was pleased with the outcome, telling reporters, "He got what he deserves, but it doesn't bring them back." He was remanded to the Mississippi State Penitentiary's death row in the Supermax Security Unit, number 32. Normally, I would tell you that this is where the story ends, give my thank yous, give my shout outs, but it's not. On June 19th, 2006, it was reported that Jennifer McBride was in the hospital as a result of a suicide attempt. There aren't many details available, but she did end up passing that same day. Some community members think that it's because she lost pretty much all of her family in a short period of time. She lost her father, then her mother, and now her brother, and it was just too much for her to handle, and so she took her life as a result. That's pure speculation based off of my research, but I can see how she was overcome with grief. Ernest's actions affected the entire family. It catapulted tragedy to everyone who knew and loved him and Michael. Some would say justice was served on August 28, 2007, when Ernest was found stabbed over 30 times in his unit. He was stabbed to death by inmate Jesse Wilson. He was later pronounced dead at 8:53 p.m. This sad tale of jealousy and greed is one that we hear about time and time again. It's sad that people allow things like this to get in the way of having familial bonds. My hope is that the Hargan family and Hint's family are able to move forward from the tragedy that befell them 13 years ago. I know the show's short for this one, but there honestly just was not a lot of information available. I felt that it was important to cover because the crime committed was so heinous, and the karma that befell Ernest was genuinely uncanny. Nobody expected him to die before his execution date, but that unit, Unit 32 in that Supermax prison, has actually been under investigation several times because multiple inmates before and after Ernest have died as a result of inmate-to-inmate violence. The ACLU was even involved, and it's very interesting that, by a twist of fate, Ernest ended up in that prison. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcast. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram. And of course, our website is truecrimefanclub.com. If you have an episode request or a general suggestion, you can send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. I would like to thank our most recent Patreon supporters, Samantha B., Tanisha F., and one of my very favorite podcasts, They Walk Among Us. Thank you so much for your generous patronage. I really do hope you continue enjoying the show. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Their work will be featured in all of our episodes, so check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams. I'll be announcing a contest soon for listeners to come up with the ending tagline of the show. I think it's a great way for us to interact and for you to have a piece of what you make possible. The prize will include a $25 Amazon gift card and a swag bag filled with merch goodies. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for more details. Now, here are some of my favorite podcasts introducing themselves to you.
You've heard the names before. Daryl Massey, Fred Hanna, Christina Gutierrez. You know the location. But have you heard this name?
This call is from
Richard Nicholas,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility. This call will be recorded and monitored.
A 2-year-old girl was murdered.
From moment one, she just laughed and smiled. She was a beautiful baby. And nothing mattered but getting to know her. And she was just like a ray of light. I mean, she was just a breath of fresh air. She was just, oh my gosh, she was like an angel.
And her father was convicted. Did you kill her?
No, I did not. I did not shoot my daughter.
Subscribe now to Convicted, coming late April. More information at convictedpod.com.
My friend Brooke created this podcast, and just by listening to that trailer, I'm hooked. It's going to be released April 24th, but you can subscribe now wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's a podcast? Find me a podcast.
The Pints and Puzzles Podcast.
You're listening to. You're listening to my dad.
I'm TJ from the Pints and Puzzles Podcast. What is the Pints and Puzzles Podcast? Exploring history's mysterious, unexplained, and strange cases with some craft beer tips and tastes along the way. The Pints and Puzzles Podcast.
Stay tuned for an exciting announcement for podcast listeners from podcast listeners. Here's Jeremy from Podcasts We Listen To.
Hi, this is Jeremy from the Podcasts We Listen To podcast. I wanted to take a second to talk to you about a thing that we're putting together called PodCon 2018. This is a convention of podcast listeners for podcast listeners and by podcast listeners. And yeah, hosts are listeners too. I listen all day long. This is going to be the fall of 2018 in New Orleans, and it's going to be a blast. It's being put together by myself, members of the Podcast We Listen To Facebook group, and hosts of several of your favorite shows, including Dina from Twisted Philly and Allie from Insight. Fall of 2018 gives us time to put it together right. We're really looking forward to it. There is so much excitement. The Podcast We Listen To Facebook group is blowing up over it. For more information, you can join the Podcast We Listen To Facebook group, or you can follow at PodCon 2018 on Twitter. And as soon as we finalize more details, we will put those out there for you. In the meantime, just keep listening to your favorite shows, and you'll probably hear something about it.